This is Stoppage Time. I'm Hayden Herrera. Thanks for listening. Episode 3. Wow. And boy, have we got a guest for you tonight. Really excited. But before we get started, I want to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at Stoppage Time Pod and on Facebook, Stoppage Time with Hayden Herrera. Thank you for everyone that listens to us on Podomatic.com. We reached the top 10 last week in the TV film category, which is really exciting. And I'm hoping this episode will get us even higher. Now, on to our surprise guest. Really pumped about this one. You can find him on Studio B with Shepard Smith and the Fox Report on Fox News Channel. He's covered more stories around the world than just about any other reporter on Fox News, or in the country for that matter. We taped this yesterday on the 3rd. This is going on the web on the 4th, so here it is. And joining us from New York, the chief correspondent for Fox News Channel's Fox Report, Jonathan Hunt. Jonathan, thanks for appearing on Stoppage Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Hayden. Great to be here.
First of all, I want to ask you, is there snow in your apartment still from this massive snowstorm you guys had?
No, you know, we got a few inches here in New York, but it's cleared up and melted pretty quick. We're back up in the 50s today. North of the city, it was a lot worse, and west out in western New Jersey, but we're pretty good here, thanks.
Okay, good to know. Well, first I want to start off with, where exactly did you grow up, for those of us that don't know?
Well, the accent's the giveaway, I guess. I grew up in the UK. I mean, I have been accused of faking the accent and that I'm really from Ames, Iowa, but that's not true. I was born in Devon, which is down in the southwest of England, and then moved to a town, seaside resort called Weston-super-Mare in Somerset, which is, again, still the southwest. Was there from 9 to 18, really. It's a funny little seaside resort. I'd recommend everybody go take a look. Not the greatest place in the world, but it's home.
Okay. And what did your parents do while you were living there?
My dad was a travel agent all his life. I guess a job that doesn't exist now with everybody booking everything on the internet, but he did all right. And mom was an elementary school teacher her entire life. She's retired now. Dad died a few years ago, but mom retired and spent her life teaching young kids. So I got a good educational start, fortunately.
Now, I read that you played as a teenager, you played some soccer and rugby. Did you ever dream of playing for the Three Lions?
No, I was never quite that good. I did all right. You know, I was in, you know, a decent schoolboy player, captained a team there called Hutton Villa for a while, and then captained the Weston-super-Mare town team at under 18. So I did all right. I was probably a better kind of leader figure than I was an actual player. My silky skills were not exactly that silky.
Gotcha. Now, I know that Somerset doesn't have a Premier League team, but what was your favorite soccer club growing up?
Oh, the big city in Somerset was Bristol. So I was a Bristol City fan who are, let's not even talk about where they're languishing now, but suffice to say they are not in the Premier League.
Yeah, not exactly. Well, growing up in England, can you remember when you first got interested in journalism?
Yeah, you know, weirdly I can. This is going to age me terribly. But when American forces were withdrawing from Vietnam, one of my first TV images that I really remember, so I would have been, I guess, about 10 years old, 1975, that would have been. I really remember that iconic shot of them loading everything onto one of the aircraft carriers off the coast of off of Saigon and pushing one of the helicopters off into the ocean so that they could load more people and more gear on there. And I just thought, wow, that is an extraordinary thing. I want to be in places like that. I want to see things like that. And then on top of that, there was one of the Middle East wars around that time. And a very famous BBC reporter who then, when he was much older, I actually ended up working with at Sky News, called Keith Graves, was standing, and I can't exactly remember where he was. But I remember seeing him shooting. It was a stand-up. It wasn't live in those days, obviously, but it was a stand-up in a package that he had done. And I remember seeing, like, in the distance behind him, this rocket exploding and thinking, wow, that is so cool. I want to be there. And, you know, from that age on, I never, my mom and dad would have told you, I never wavered in what I wanted to do. I wanted to do journalism.
So just throughout school, that's what you prepared for?
Yeah. I loved writing. Was always, loved all English writing. I could do creative writing classes and all of that. I was obsessed with news, just watched it every day, read a lot of newspapers. My father always used to read the Daily Telegraph, which was a sort of conservative, not in the very right wing sense, but a conservative sort of paper. And he used to work away during the week. So during the week, as soon as he went away, I would go down to the newspaper store who used to deliver our papers as it worked in England then. And I would cancel the Daily Telegraph and order the Guardian, which was a very left-wing newspaper. And then he'd come back every Friday night, get his newspaper on a Saturday morning and thinking, what the heck's this? I hate the Guardian. And he'd change it again. And we had this running joke for several years. But so I read the newspapers. And I was just fascinated by news and watched it all on TV, obviously, and loved it.
So I imagine colleges are different in the UK than they are in America a little bit. How did you decide on which college you wanted to attend?
Which one would have me? Things went on in the family and everything. My parents ended up divorcing and my grades kind of sank a little after that, at just the wrong time for college entry. I ended up at a college, which is a good college, down on the South Coast called Portsmouth. And they had a very good international politics course there, which is what I was really interested in. So I ended up graduating down there. And, I had 3 years which weren't necessarily the best socially there, mainly because I was a complete misfit. I learned a lot of good things and had a good time academically speaking, at least.
Okay, so from there you graduate. How's the job search going?
Well, it was interesting. These days everybody there were no journalism courses in college in those days, so I didn't exactly train myself to be a journalist. There were some postgrad courses, but no undergrad courses. Postgrad course I simply couldn't afford to do. I'd racked up too much debt and everything, and the bank was saying, no, I think it's time you went to work. So I looked around and I thought, how am I going to get the job that I want? I knew I wanted to be in London. So I wrote to a bunch of newspapers, a bunch of magazines, a bunch of radio stations saying, hey, can I come and work for you for free? I'll prove that I'm, worthy of you. And the first organization that wrote back to me was a magazine called Time Out, in London, which was not a news magazine really at all. But they gave me a job. They said, come and work for 2 weeks for nothing. And then, we'll see if we want to keep you after that. So I thought, all right, I'll do it. So I moved to London and worked for them. And at the end of it, they gave me a job, bizarrely enough, mainly writing restaurant reviews. So that's where my love of food comes from, I guess, and all my chins.
So was your job with Sky News that far away from that point?
No, then I always knew I wanted to do news. So I was with them I was with Time Out about 6 months. And then I moved to a local newspaper in London called The Post Group. And from there, I always knew I wanted to end up in TV. So I did this sort of old-fashioned progression. Newspapers, from there I went to radio. And then Sky News was just launching. I was fortunate in that sense. So they were taking anybody at that point, really. And I was one of the nobodies that they were willing to take a chance on. So I ended up with Sky News probably about 6 months after they launched in the UK. I think that would have been around 91, probably 91 or 92, something like that. And they gave me a job as a freelance reporter and then took me on staff. So, yeah, I was lucky.
Now, reading your bio, you got to cover some amazing events while you were at Sky News. What's the most memorable event to you?
Well, for me, after I'd been there a few years, they made me their United States correspondent based in Washington, D.C. And I was there for nearly 5 years. I went in 1995. The Oklahoma City bombing was one of the very first story, in fact, that I covered in the U.S., that was obviously a staggering story. The first time we'd seen an act of terrorism that devastating on American soil, I guess. So that was extraordinary. The first time I smelled the smell of death as well, which hung over Oklahoma City in the days after that. That was amazing. And then I was there, you know, I was lucky enough to be there throughout the Clinton years. And whether you agree with him politically or disagree with him politically, by God, he was a good president to cover as a journalist. He gave us a lot of material from, you know, from all the things he did, you know, from his fight to bring about a settlement in the Middle East, which was fascinating, the way he interacted with the Northern Irish peace process and actually did a lot. To the sleazier side of it, Monica Lewinsky and everything. Everything he did was great material for us. So, the impeachment proceedings up on Capitol Hill, that was a historic moment. Amazing to be there for that. And also, you know, Hayden, there were only two of us, two correspondents for Sky News covering the entire country. And Britain is obsessed with America. So I could call up my news editors and say, listen, I've heard of this guy who rears two-legged goats in Montana. I think we should go and do a piece on it. And they'd say, sure, that sounds great. Off you go. So I traveled everywhere and met the most amazing people. And I think in those 5 years, I went to 48 of the 50 states. So it was an amazing experience all around.
Well, so when you got the job, was that your first time in America?
I had visited once before. I'd always wanted to come. I for some reason, I was obsessed with the United States when I was a little boy. Near my house in a city called Bath, when I was growing up, there was a Museum of the Americas. And I used to make my mom take me there pretty much every weekend, the poor woman. She must have been completely bored with it after about two visits. But I used to make her take me there all the time. So I'd always wanted to come, but I could never afford it. But I made one visit a couple of years before I was posted here to Chicago. I think it was right around Christmas. Chicago was under about 6 feet of snow. And I walked out that morning. I got up really early with jet lag, walked out and just looked at the Chicago cityscape and thought, wow, this is the country I want to live in. I love this. I knew I was home.
You two, working for Sky News, were the only ones for the entire country, correct?
Yes, two reporters covering the entire country.
That had to be intimidating. How did you guys handle that?
It was just great. There was so much news. We'd sit down every day really and decide what day turn stories we needed to do, what was the news of the day. But then we just we'd read everything and see other things on American TV and think, wow, that's a story that people in Britain and across Europe, because Sky was broadcast across Europe, that's the kind of story that people would be fascinated by. So we'd just go and do it. I did a long on immigration, spent a lot of time down on the border, both sides of the border in Mexico and in Southern California, Arizona, etc. That people are fascinated by that. One, the desperation on the Mexican side, why so many people want to come across, and two, the reaction to that on the American side of the border. That was fascinating. Just so many just really interesting stories. You could literally, I think there's a guy on CBS who does this, who throws a dart at a phone book or something and then goes, yeah, does a story with those people. Steve Hartman maybe is his name. But it's literally like that. You can put a pin in a map anywhere in America and you'll find a fascinating story.
You said, okay, 48 out of 50 states. Do you remember getting to work in Arkansas at all?
Yes. Sadly, my one working visit to Arkansas during that time was the Jonesboro school shootings, which was also, interestingly, my first experience of a dry county.
Oh, wow.
I'd never heard of such a thing before. So we worked hard that day, dreadful story. And like a lot of journalists, we felt we needed a drink at the end of it. So I had this first experience of driving across a county line to buy a beer. It was
It's very, very prevalent around here.
Yeah.
Now, while working with Sky News, did you notice a big difference in the styles between U.S. journalism and British journalism?
I think one of the key differences is that in Britain, the newspapers are very opinionated. Everybody knows exactly what everybody knows. The Guardian is a liberal newspaper. Everybody knows the Telegraph is a conservative newspaper. Nobody's that bothered. You go out and you buy whichever one you want. Nobody criticizes them for having a point of view. Here it's whereas television in Britain is strictly controlled. by the, I think it's the, I can't remember what the name of the organization is now, but it's a governmental organization that does not allow bias or outright bias on TV. Here, it's kind of the reverse. You know, we see Fox, MSNBC, CNN, to some extent, all coming from a particular point of view, whereas the newspapers tend to be pretty much down the middle and, you know, other than their opinion pages, less obvious opinion in them. So I think that was an interesting difference. Also, one thing I also noticed in Washington was how the rules with which journalists play by when dealing with the president and other high-ranking officials and politicians. In Britain, if the prime minister was holding a press conference, we would ask him anything. If he was walking by us in the street, you'd ask him anything. Mm-hmm. Here, the journalists play by such a strict set of rules. And I think, to some extent, that's a bit of a weakness here. Journalists should be allowed to shout out any question they want at any point. Within the guidelines of basic manners, not when the president's in the middle of a speech or something, but to keep us away from him when he's doing something, when he's walking a rope line or something. Those are the moments you want to catch people and talk to them, because that's the moment when their guard is down. They're less prepared to give you the stock answers. And I think that's a strength of British journalism that we don't... I was going to say kowtow, that's probably the wrong word, but we don't allow those who rule to set those kind of rules on us about when we're allowed to ask them questions.
Okay. Now, I don't get to watch a lot of British journalism. The only show that I know you're not a sports guy, but I get to watch Sky Sports News on Fox Soccer Channel.
Right.
And I noticed that... it's very, very different from ESPN SportsCenter. Is that another thing where it's a sense of just like strictly news on their programs? Because on SportsCenter, you know, I think a lot of sportscasters feel the need to, you know, crack jokes and get the audience, give it a lighthearted sense. But I don't feel the same way while watching Sky Sports News.
What you think they're just more about the give us the news, here's the results?
Right, right.
Yeah. Probably, which is weird, because if there's one place where you can show a little bit of humor and have some fun, it's sport. I think sports coverage here in the United States is amazing. I think one of the guys who's changed that, who started off is wrong. I'm sure he was working in various places before that, but where he first made a huge impact was at Sky Sports, a guy called David Hill, who is now a big deal. And I'm not sure that he's still in charge of the sports channels, but he was the one who kind of revolutionized a lot of the way sports was covered here. Sports is one of those things that you want to, I think when you switch on TV, you want to hear the kind of conversations you'd have over a beer with your friends.
Right.
And I think American sports coverage and sports news shows do that a lot better. I love Michael Wilbon, and who's Mike Wilbon's sidekick?
Kornheiser, Tony Kornheiser.
That's right. I love those two. I don't know if they're even still on, but they're great. That's the kind of discussion you want. Two guys or two women just going at it, arguing about sports. It's great. What's better than that?
Now, did you ever have any interest in working in sports journalism, or is it strictly news?
Really for me, it was always news. I love the international nature of news, and I love the war zones. I just find them fascinating and such an adrenaline rush. But yeah, I mean, I often look at the guy. I mean, my big sport is rugby, not exactly a big sport here.
Right.
But I often look at the guys or read their copy in the British papers or watch the guys covering, the Rugby World Cup was just finished, and think, that's a pretty darn good life, just wandering around following a sport you love. So, yes, but I think I'm not sure the challenge would be there to keep me interested long enough.
Just in a sense of the stories you cover?
Yeah, in a sense that it goes round and round. I think you'd feel as though you were doing the same thing.
Right.
Year after year after year. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously a great life. I don't know. Maybe it's something I should think about if anybody would have me. If ESPN is listening...
We can get you with Ian Dark on their Premier League broadcast.
There we go. Yes. All right. I'll take any offers.
Now, okay, so you work for Sky News in America, and how does Fox News get into play in your career?
After the 2000 election, which, as you might remember, went on forever with all the recounts down in Florida, when that was finally decided, Sky thought in British with British foreign assignments, they tend to move you around after every 5 years here. And they said, okay, we think it's time to move on and try something else. So we'd like you to go and be our Europe correspondent, covering all of Europe, based in Brussels, Belgium. So I went over there, and it was kind of fun, but I really missed the United States. And after about 10 months there, I just thought, no, this isn't right for me. I want to see if I can get a green card and go back and work and live in the United States and make that my home. So I got my green card. I spoke to a friend who knows about these things, and he said, listen, if you want to get a green card quickly, and this was just after 9/11, he said, it's hard to do now, but he said one of the places that processes them more quickly in the English-speaking world is New Zealand. So if you want to go and apply through the American consulate there, that might be your best bet. So I did exactly that, and he was exactly right. 6 months later, I got my green card, came over to New York, went to see a man called John Moody, who was then running Fox News, immediately under Roger Ailes. And I knew John a little bit from my years with Sky here. Obviously, there's a connection between Sky and Fox. So I knew John, and I went to see him and said, please, sir, give me a chance. And he was nice enough to say, yes, I have an opening for someone to go to Afghanistan for 6 weeks. How do you fancy that? So I said, sure. And off I went to Afghanistan. And, fortunately enough, after that, they, for some bizarre reason, decided to give me a full-time job.
Wow. Now, while working in Afghanistan and Iraq, obviously us in America, we've only seen, just what we see on TV. Can you kind of describe what the atmosphere is like over there?
It's interesting. From a working point of view, it's amazing. We all, in those situations, we all tend to arrive, in Kabul in terms of Afghanistan, then in Baghdad in terms of Iraq. We all arrive. You have this big foreign press corps arriving. We usually identify one or two hotels that everybody's in. So there's this great sort of spirit among the press corps. Everybody's in the same place. You're in a dangerous place, so there's that bonds you all together. And then when it becomes clear that we're going to be there a long, long time, what the organizations tend to do these days is all get a house because you can arrange your own security at a house. You can be a little bit more confident of who's around you. So we did that. And in Kabul, that was probably my first experience of living in a house. And I always liken it a little bit to I always say somebody should do a reality show called Big Brother Warzone and see who gets voted out of the house first. It's an amazing experience. There's a lot of pressure, a lot of camaraderie, a lot of fun, a lot of tension at times, but it's an extraordinary experience. So I did that. In terms of the atmosphere on the ground in Kabul at that stage, it was not as dangerous, I would say, as it is now. I think Kabul's probably become more dangerous recently. But then, there were the attacks on, there was an attack on the UN while I was there, one of the UN buildings. There was an attack on a hotel while I was there. So you're always on your guard. But at the same time, the kidnapping of Americans and other Westerners hadn't really started at that point. We used to, I think about the way we'd have a security guy with us, but we used to walk around the streets of downtown Kabul in a way that we certainly would not now. So it's changed a lot, I think.
There wasn't a constant feel of, hey, I'm in imminent danger.
No. I mean, you were always aware that you could be, but no, we walked around the streets. There's a street in downtown Kabul which I'm not sure it's its real name, but every foreigner knew it as Chicken Street. It's where all the stores are, the little stores. It's where we went to buy provisions every day. And it was a fascinating little store, actually. They imported a lot of, you know, American and British kind of goods to eat and everything. And every day we went in there, the bill was always the same. It was always $200. We could go in and buy a week's worth of food for all of us, or we could go in and buy two packets of cookies, and somehow it was always $200.
Wow.
Written on the back of a scrap of paper. But, you know, we'd walk around those sort of places, and no, we weren't that concerned. These days you would be, I think, far more concerned. And certainly when I was in Iraq and spent a lot of time in Baghdad immediately after the war, around the Iraqi National Museum and wandering around there because of the looting there. We were doing an investigative series there. And I walked the streets of Fallujah, which became a nightmarish city. And I was there a year later, and everything had changed then. You know, we were in, bulletproof vests, a lot of security, and it was a very different place. So, yeah, you have to judge it on a case-by-case basis. You have to always be aware in any of those kind of places, but sometimes you just have to really hunker down and say, all right, we are not straying beyond the confines of our safe house today. You know, and we have great security people. Fox is very, very good at looking after its people in those kind of places, and I think every one of us who's ever worked in a war zone for them is very grateful for that.
When was the last time you were out on the field?
Last time I was out in the field in a war zone?
Right, right.
The last time, probably in a real active war zone, would have been 2006 when I was in, first of all, I was down in Gaza immediately after the kidnapping of Gilad Shalit, that young Israeli soldier who was just released, finally, 5 years later. I was in Gaza then when the Israelis started rolling in, and then a few weeks after that, the Israeli war with Lebanon, well, not with Lebanon, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, began, and I was up in Beirut for that. And that was a very scary war in a lot of places. We wanted to spend some time in the Hezbollah neighborhoods, finding out what makes them tick and also seeing what was going on there. And that was a point. There were points there at which we just got caught in the middle of some of those Israeli air raids, and those were not fun at all. Trying to get out of there because they're dropping some powerful bombs there on their Hezbollah targets, and that was kind of scary. On the other side as well, a lot of colleagues on the Israeli side who were also very scared. The Hezbollah rockets were being lobbed into Israeli towns and cities as well, so they were pretty scared too. So that was a scary time. Other dodgy areas more recently, I was in on the Tunisian-Libyan border when the uprising in Libya started. We were making a lot of attempts to get in to Libya, then across from the western side, which nobody had done from Tunisia. Everybody had gone in from Egypt, which was the side controlled by the rebels, so it was relatively safe. We were trying to go in on the side still controlled by Gaddafi, and it was very unsafe, and a lot of my colleagues who pushed it a little too far, not Fox colleagues, but from other organizations, ended up held by the Libyan army and Libyan mercenaries for a while, and some scary times there too.
So you still get to, Fox still sends you out every once in a while, but now, would you say most of your work is based in the studio?
Yeah, I would say most of it is. Now, for whatever reason, Shepard Smith and his producers have decided they like having me there every day. Shep and I have a good relationship, and we have some fun on the set. So it's become more studio-based. I tend to go out for one or two big stories. This year, whatever I've been out in the field, in terms of the bigger stories, for the Libyan thing I just mentioned. Also, I was in London for the royal wedding. They had to send the Brit, obviously, to the royal wedding. So I did that. And I'm actually, interestingly enough, we're thinking about going back to Iraq at the end of this year for the withdrawal of the last American troops. So maybe back there then. But yes, the vast majority of my work, I'd probably say 70% of my work now is in studio.
And was it through your reporting in the field that got you a part on Shepard Smith's show?
That's, I guess so, yeah. I mean, I guess we'd have to ask Shep that question and Kim Rosenberg, who is the brilliant executive producer of Shep shows. They were looking for a new chief correspondent, and for whatever reason, they picked me. Yeah, I've done a lot with Shep shows from out in the field, and I think they liked the rapport that Shep and I had, and that we had some humor in some of the stories that we did and had some fun together. And, you know, personalities on TV, you either click or you don't. And
right.
They felt that we clicked, so they gave me the opportunity. So.
Yeah, you guys definitely click, believe me.
Well,
now, I know every day's got to be completely different, but is there... Kind of walk us through what a day in the studio living in New York is like for you.
Yeah, for me, my day usually starts around probably around 7:30. Not in the office, but I'm here at home where I am now. Around 7:30 in the morning, we start exchanging emails with Kim Rosenberg, the executive producer of the show, talking about what story that I'm going to cover that day. It's usually either, you know, one of the most important stories of the day, or it's something that we think isn't being covered anywhere else, is quirky, is interesting, people are going to find interesting. So we start talking and banding around ideas then. Then I usually go into the office around 11, and at noon every day I do a show at foxnews.com live. We do live streaming now for, I think, 7 hours a day at live.foxnews.com, if anybody wants to check it out. And I do a show at noon Eastern every day for an hour. So I've already, also before I go in, I've been talking to the producers of that show about what we're going to do. So then I anchor that show, which is generally, it's pretty free-ranging. We try to pick up what people are looking at online, what's trending on Google Trends, what the most read stories are on foxnews.com, and focus on those. We have reporters joining us, we have guests coming in, a political discussion, etc. So that's a really fun hour. I love doing that. So I finish that at 1, and then I talk to my producer, Lissa Kaplan, who's great, who produces everything I do for Shep shows. And we start working, she's already been working for a couple of hours on what we're going to do on Shep shows. We get that together, decide, you know, I do any interviews that we're going to do for that. Then I start thinking about what I'm going to say. I don't tend to script things. A lot of TV reporters, you know, write out everything they do. They have a script in prompter. I prefer not to. I think it's fresher and more, frankly, more entertaining for me if it's not totally scripted, and I can play a little more with Shep then as well. So then I show up. I go off to makeup. Yes, I do have to have makeup. A lot of makeup in my case, actually. I go off to makeup around 2:30, and then end up on the set with Shep around 3 Eastern for Studio B. And then between, so the show finished, and I'm in the studio the entire time because I work on breaking news with Shep. So he's got somebody to play off and talk to and find more information from if there's a big breaking news. Then 4 o'clock, I go get a cup of coffee. And then between 4 and 7, when 7 Eastern, when we do the Fox report, Lissa, my producer, and I work on how we might change the story, if there's any new developments, etc. And then I turn up, do the same for 7, you know, do my appearance with Shep. And again, I'm in the studio for any breaking news that happens.
Now, working for Fox News, I imagine since you're a national reporter, there's rarely a time when content is low. But can you remember ever a time where you said, man, this is just a slow news day? And how do you work with that?
Oh, there's a lot of slow news days. Yeah, there's days when we think, oh, my word, the only thing we can actually do is Lindsay Lohan's latest court appearance or something. But, yeah, there are slow news days. I mean, I think we're living in fairly extraordinary times. Well, which makes us very fortunate as journalists right now, in that there's so much going on globally and nationally. So there's less slow days. I don't remember too many slow days this year. But, you know, today, for instance, I was talking to Kim, the executive producer, this morning. We're looking around thinking, well, you know, we've got all our, you know, fabulous political people that Fox employs in Washington. They're covering all the big stories of the day, which are political really today. We have amazing business people from the Fox Business Network covering those. So what am I going to do today? There's nothing that really fired us up today. And then we found this story, which I think a lot of people are going to be talking about this judge down in Texas who there's a video. His daughter, who's now 23, released this extraordinary video that she had secretly recorded of him, the judge, who deals with child abuse cases, beating her with a belt. It's a disturbing story and a difficult one to cover, but I think a lot of people are going to think, you know, two things. Wow, what on earth was going on in that home that the judge who deals with these child abuse cases was beating her like that? Is that discipline or is that abuse? A lot of people are going to wonder that. And then secondly, what is going on in the mind of the 23-year-old daughter now that she wants to out her father nationally about this? She says she wants to make him change. So the psychology of all of that is fascinating, and Kim and I talked about it. We think it's a story that has to be handled delicately. The video is very tough to look at, so I don't think we'll be showing much, if any, of that. But it raises a lot of points about, you know, discipline in the home, you know, parent-child relationships, and the psychology of a woman who's gone through what she's gone through and then has decided to sort of turn on her father in a sense. So it's an interesting story, and one we think a lot of people will be interested in. So that's what I'll be doing on Studio B and Fox Report today.
Right. I had been on Twitter. I saw one or two tweets about that, not much. So I'll be interested to see that story.
Yeah, it's disturbing. It's one of those that you want to handle really carefully, but right. We'll try to do that.
Right. Now, I noticed that I would say you're a rather private person. We don't see you on TMZ, and Jon Stewart doesn't take cheap shots at you on The Daily Show. Is that hard to do in this business? And how does one achieve that kind of privacy?
I think you just. I mean, I don't go out to clubs. I live here in New York with my fiance. We like nothing more than, you know, curling up on the couch and watching a movie in the evenings. I think it's easy to find notoriety if you want it, but it's really in the end not that hard to steer clear of it either. I mean, it's about the choices you make. Yeah, if you want to appear on every red carpet or whatever, sure. And you want to go to the latest nightclubs and hang around those kind of people, fine. You can get your name in the papers. Hello, Kim Kardashian and Paris Hilton. But, you know, if you don't want to, that's why I find it somewhat disingenuous when celebrities complain all the time about having their privacy invaded. Yes, it happens to some extent, but do they go looking for it a lot of the time? Yes, they certainly do. It's easy to stay under the radar. And having said that, let's face it, I'm not in the same realm as a Tom Brokaw or Brian Williams or even a Shepard Smith. You know, I'm a reporter. I'm not, you know, there's a small, deeply disturbed bunch of people who might recognize me in the street, but not so many. But the bottom line is it's easy to stay away from the cameras, from the, you know, Page Six writers if you need to.
Right. So wait a second. Are you telling me that you're no private jets, no chauffeur? I thought I saw a security guard behind you there.
No, that's probably a teddy bear, actually. No, certainly no private jets, I wish. No chauffeurs. I walk to the office every day or take the subway. I occasionally jump in the back of a cab. But that's my – I love the subway in New York, and I love walking the streets of the city, and which is what I do almost every day. I walk to and from work. It's about a 20-minute walk from where I am to our Midtown offices.
Okay, and so when people see you on the street, what's the normal response you usually get?
Hey, loser.
Oh, no, come on.
And, you know, most people actually who stop me are really nice. They say, hey, love your work. Love Fox. You know, thanks for doing what you're doing. People are, you know, generally very polite. And then, you know, you'll get a little criticism too. You know, there's certain people, as we all know, who don't like Fox News, who, you know, frankly put us all in one spot. Roger Ailes, who runs Fox News, has said very often, we have our news shows and we have our opinion shows. And I think anybody who watches Studio B and the Fox Report with me and Shep would say that it's a very balanced, down-the-middle newscast. And then Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity do their thing, which is a different thing. But, you know, sometimes we are judged all as one entity. And if I was to go, you know, I've been down a couple of times now to the Occupy Wall Street protests, for instance, in downtown Manhattan here. And as soon as I walk around and say I'm from Fox News, I'm not exactly popular there. And they'll shout things that are a little less than complimentary. But, you know, that's life.
Well, I'm sure it's not personal. I'm sure it's not personal. Now I know you're. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you, so I'll only have a few more questions. Now, through your career, who's the most interesting person you've ever interviewed?
The most interesting. Wow, that's a good question. Very early on, when I was in newspapers in London, one of the areas I covered was the area that Margaret Thatcher represented, and. Talking to her then was fascinating. I mean, she's such an intimidating figure as Prime Minister of Britain at that time. Actually, no, was she still Prime Minister? Yes, she was still Prime Minister, yes, when I was in newspapers. And she was fascinating, intimidating, scary, all of those things. Loved talking to her. Other people, you know, I think ordinary people are the ones who are actually the most interesting. You know, the guys that we would talk to on the streets in a place like Kabul or in Baghdad, Fallujah, and it's some of the most interesting people I've met, and what I've learned the most from, I think, are the people who live under constant threat of extreme violence. And I'm thinking there in particular, because it's gone on so long, of Israel and Gaza, and which are, you know, leaving aside all the politics, people in Gaza live under extremely difficult, impoverished circumstances, the Palestinians there, and there's the threat of an Israeli rocket strike at any time, which is usually targeted, but obviously can catch civilians in it.
Right.
Very tough circumstances to live in, but people with an amazing spirit who just get up and keep going. And I was there in, I think it would have been the summer of 2005, when there was an ongoing campaign by the Israelis. And there would be a rocket which would hit a car, perhaps take out a couple of civilians too, as well as the militants that they were targeting almost every morning. And then at the same afternoon, the entire city of Gaza City would be celebrating a wedding because it was wedding season.
Wow.
You know, they'd pick up, they'd dress up, and they'd get on with the next thing in life. The same on the other side, the Israelis. The bus bombings, which were common at that point. There was one. I was staying at a hotel called the American Colony in Jerusalem at one point, and there was an awful bus bombing just a couple hundred yards from the center of the hotel, and I ran out there. I was one of the first on the scene, almost the same time as emergency services, which is rare, before they'd put up the tape to cordon us all off. And I remember vividly seeing one of the emergency service workers giving mouth-to-mouth to a baby who could not have been older than 12 months. And there was literally blood running down the streets. Yet 2 hours later, everything had been cleaned up. The wreckage of the bus had been moved, and cars were going around that same roundabout exactly the same way as they had been just before the bombing happened. The spirit of those people who just keep going in those circumstances, again, leaving aside the politics of it all, is just quite extraordinary. And one other thing, Hayden, I'm rambling a bit here, but U.S. troops. And, you know, so from other nations as well, but I've spent more time with the U.S. troops. I've always said to everybody, whatever you think of the wars we've fought over the last decade, do not ever have anything but total respect for the guys who fight those wars on our behalf. You spend 5 minutes with them, and they are great men and women, and they are just doing their job. They signed up to do a job like all of us. Sometimes our bosses tell us something to do something we don't want to do. But you do it because that's your job. Those men and women are just doing their job, and they're extraordinary. So, yeah, I'd put them at the top of the most interesting people I've met. Actually, the service men and women.
Yeah, no arguing with you there. Mm. Now, in journalism, how do you define success in your field?
I would personally define success by loving your job. I don't think I have had a single day when I have gone to work and thought, oh, another day at work. I've been lucky enough to always do something that I absolutely love. I think that's success in journalism, in life, really. If you can do something you love every day, then you're pretty successful. It's not about the money. I mean, we all sit around and look at our bank accounts every now and then and think, oh, I need more money. You know, whether you're, you know, working at Target, whether you're working in TV, all the different levels, everybody thinks they need more. I'm sure Kim Kardashian thinks she needs more money. But, you know, if you love what you're doing, then you're successful.
Can you imagine what you'd be doing in life if you weren't in journalism?
Yeah, no, I can't. I'd probably be on the side of a street with my hand out. What I would love to do, and what I kind of still I wish I'd tried doing when I was younger, way too late now, was acting. Really? I think it's a great to be able to inhabit another character. And be that character for a while is fascinating, which might say something about how unhappy I am with my own character, that I'd want to be someone else. But I just think it's a fascinating thing. And yeah, having said that as well, these days, the way TV's going, TV news is going, there's an element of acting in TV as well, where we are sometimes showmen as well as reporters.
Right, right.
But don't tell anybody else I said that.
Oh, no, I won't. No, no. It's between us. Now, finally, working with Shepard Smith, he's no secret, he's a big Almost Rebel fan. Has he converted you? I really hope not, being an Arkansas fan, but does he have that postered all over the office?
All over his office, yes. He is obsessed with those Rebels. But I have to say, having spent a lot of time in Fayetteville with a former colleague of yours, who's now my fiance, Chelsea Edwards. I'm sticking with the Hogs. Don't worry.
Woo pig suey all the way. Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for this time. It's been a real treat. Remember, you can catch Jonathan on the Fox Report with Shepard Smith. That's at 7 p.m. Eastern, right?
7 Eastern and 3 Eastern for Studio B.
Right, and you have On the Hunt on FoxNews.com.
On the Hunt at FoxNews.com, noon Eastern.
Very interactive, right?
Yes, very interactive. We take comments from our viewers. We get emails, tweets. They can put comments on Facebook and everything. It's a great, fun show, and we really love the interaction with the viewers. So come on in anytime.
Yeah, I might have to get on there during.
You should.
Yeah, I've got class. But I'll bring my laptop and try to get on there.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a real treat. You're someone I really respect in journalism, and just thank you for being on Stoppage Time.
All right. My pleasure, Hayden, and I hope one day when you're big and powerful, you'll hire me when I'm begging for a job.
Oh, no.
Because
no,
you will be big and powerful.
Oh, you're... Stop it. You're too nice.
Thanks, Hayden.
There you go. Jonathan Hunt, ladies and gentlemen. What a nice guy. And a Razorback fan. Very gracious with his time. I had so many questions I wanted to ask him I didn't get to, because we would have been going all day. But I loved hearing about his time in the Middle East. That is the assignment of a lifetime. Hearing about his daily routine at Fox News. You know, he's a very humble guy, and that's what I admire about him. One more time, you can catch Jonathan weekdays on Studio B with Shepard Smith at 3 p.m. Eastern, and on the Fox Report weeknights at 7 p.m. Eastern, and On the Hunt on live.foxnews.com at noon Eastern. Finally tonight, as many of you know, our Vegas expert Smitty had a rough week with his picks. He's not on the show this week, but he will be on next week to explain himself and also to redeem himself with a new slate of picks for next week's games. So until then, for Jonathan Hunt, I'm Hayden Rivera. We'll see you next time.